The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I'm very pleased to welcome all of you here. He can act, he can dance, he can write, and he can sing, not to mention produce and direct. About the only thing he can't do is fly, yet. He even has his own fragrance. Well, we all do, actually. But his has a better name than yours, and it's not Alan. A consummate MC, he joins us tonight to share the surprising story of how he came to be the man he is today. Talented, cheeky, charming, adorable, and of course, very sexy. He'll be interviewed by the equally talented singer-songwriter and novelist and very sexy Wesley Stace. Please welcome Alan Cumming.
No more photos, ladies and gentlemen, please. Well, I am very delighted. Let me say thank you, first of all, to the library for always giving me the good gigs. Thanks, Andy. I don't know what I do to deserve that. I don't know how many of you have read... how long has it been out? It's very new, isn't it?
November... Thanks so much.
October 22nd, my birthday. Nice.
It's been about a month.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how many have had the pleasure of reading it. It's a really, really great and very moving book. I really, really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Tell us, for those who don't know anything about it, just set the book up a little bit and tell us why, you know, what it's about, how it's structured, and why you wrote it.
Okay, well, both the structure of it and the reason I wrote it is that 4 years ago, in 2010, I was asked to do this BBC show. They have an American version as well. It's called Who Do You Think You Are? And they trace your genealogy and they find some shocking thing about your past. And it's always famous people that do it. And the famous person cries at some point when they find out the thing. And so they asked me to do it, and I said yes, because there was a mystery in my family. My mother's father, my maternal grandfather, who died in Malaysia in 1951. And I always thought it was a bit fishy how he died. And there was this gap between the time my mum had last seen him and the time he died of 5 years. I didn't know why he hadn't come back home. So they asked if I wanted to do the show. They went off and researched my family, and including talking to my father, who I hadn't seen for 16 years because we were all estranged from him because he was very violent and abusive when we were little. And so he knew I was doing the show, plot point. And so then I was working and things, and then I flew to London to do the start filming of the show. And the night I arrived in London, my brother, who I love very dearly, older brother, came to my house at my father's behest. My father had called him up and told him to come and tell me that I wasn't his son. Yes. So that summer, I discovered all these things about my grandfather, including that the reason he didn't come back was that he was actually separated from my granny, and one of my uncles was not his son. And I discovered that he died in Malaysia playing Russian roulette. Yep. And then my father, you know, I had to investigate this whole thing with my father and go through the fact that he was, had just told me that I wasn't his son. So that was really the basis for the book. And it's also the structure for the book, because it goes back and forward in time and place, back to my childhood, to kind of explain why, for example, I hadn't seen my father for all that time. And then And then it goes forward a bit in time too, because more crazy things happened. And basically the reason I wrote it was that I couldn't stop talking about it. I just, it was such a crazy series of events that were so overwhelming to me. And, you know, like your whole, provenance was just thrown into confusion and doubt. And of course it was so many, like you gasped there twice. So people, when I would tell the story to people, and there's more gaspy moments. So I would tell it. And then interestingly, I think I wrote the book from, and I was in Scotland last week, and I think it came from an oral tradition. Like most Scottish stories come from an oral tradition, and this book came from my repeating the story to anyone, taxi drivers, the man at the deli. They'd go, "Hey, there's your coffee, how are you?" I was like, "Actually." So that's why I wrote it, and that's why the structure of it is as it is, because I'd already honed it as a good tale.
I mean, there's going to have to be spoilers tonight. You can't
Some
get away.
Spoilers.
You can't get away without it.
Well,
really?
There's one spoiler I don't want to say.
Okay.
You know?
The actual...
Yeah.
Okay.
I think, don't
so
you?
So we're talking about your book, Not My Father's Son.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Gotcha.
But you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I mean, I think if anyone hasn't read it, it's a thriller as well as it being
well,
violent. So, you know...
He is being funny, but he is not joking, because the structure that is set up of being live on a television program where your father has got in touch with you and said, "I've heard this television program's happening. Here's something that will probably come up." And then it didn't because they were going on a whole nother family drama. But you, looking back in your history live on camera, it seems unnecessarily self-afflicted, inflicted punishment in a way, because you're letting your live reaction to family history happen at the very same time. If the novel, if the memoir is to be believed, literally you're finding daily stuff out about your real true family, both on camera and in your private life.
Yeah, so this is absolutely true, but none of the version, you know, the examples they'd sent me to show me what the show was like were anywhere as shocking or incredible as my story was, right? It's normally things like, "Oh, your, you know, great, great, great grandfather was a really nice
was
priest and helped some people," and or your, you know, blah blah. They had an accident, they fell down a mine, but you know, a dog saved them, and there's things like that. this was not. I mean, and also, he was relatively near. You know, he was my grandfather. It wasn't a very old ancestor, none of the stuff with my dad was in the TV show at all. That was all just ongoing. I said that before I went to do it, before I started filming, my mom was so excited to because she was going to learn.
Find out about her dad.
I mean, and I thought, how amazing that I am able to give this gift to my mom of using, I mean, all the resources at the BBC, all the researchers, and then people flying around the world to be able to give her this gift of finding out really the story of her dad. And I say in the book, and I really meant it, this was the best thing that had ever happened to me about being famous, because I wouldn't have been asked to do it if I weren't famous. And then, you know, that afternoon in Malaysia, when this man who had known my grandfather told me he died playing Russian roulette, and there's a whole story going up to that about how he was obviously had PTSD and was affected by his army service. The interview right after I find out, I say, this is the worst thing that's happened to me about being famous. And it really was, like, I said, it truly is reality TV, because I see myself, like, you know, normally when you're, obviously when I was doing it and I'm finding out things, I'm aware there's cameras and, you know, and I'm kind of aware there's going to be a revelation up until, you know, there's various revelations.
Well, that's kind of how the show is set up.
Yeah.
They say, we're going to this field in France
to find
and you're going
blah,
to be
blah, blah.
Meeting this bloke and he's going to tell you something.
So you know something big's going to happen. And then, you know, like they say, oh, probably he went to this mental hospital after this battle. So he had like some mental issues and the British Army ripped away his medical records that had anything to do with any mental illness. And then when the bit came with the, you know, the Russian roulette was so far from outfield, left field rather, that it wasn't even in the field. It was just so shocking. And I discovered this thing about myself that I whenever I get shocking news, I fling myself backwards. Because when my brother told me about my dad that night, I flung myself away. And my friends who were down, I was on the roof of my flat in London, and my friends downstairs thought we were having a fight, and I'd been probably flung to the floor by my brother. So when I saw, normally when you, I also write in the book about being famous and about how there's so many great things I like about my life. I think being a celebrity is different from being an actor. Many great things about it. One of the things I don't like is the level of self-consciousness that you just live with every single second, and unless you're in your bed. But when you're on TV and all these, when you're on a talk show, you're like, you're kind of playing a version of yourself. But in those moments on that TV show, when I found out, I saw myself completely unselfconscious because I was so taken aback. I forgot the cameras, I forgot everything. And that was really, and I actually found that kind of really disturbing. I thought that was like how reality TV would have been, or like a sort of fly on the wall documentary 25 years ago, you know, the pioneers of it all.
Well, and yet, may I...
Yes, you may.
May I posit? Yes. May I posit that you were already, you were doing a bit of a performance then, because I think you say in the book, you know, I'm used to going and doing things when I'm not feeling 100%. You were feeling...
Shit.
Really close to very low percent, because you were waiting for DNA tests to arrive to find out whether your father, and we're going to move on to this in a moment, but your father's, you know, brutal treatment of you was in fact because he believed that you weren't his son.
Yeah.
I mean, you were hiding that much, at least.
Yeah, I was. I mean, when I see it, when I watched it quite recently, actually.
It's on YouTube, by the way.
It's on YouTube, yeah.
The whole thing's on YouTube, if you want to see this show.
Yes.
Who do you think you...
And it's weird because I was shooting a thing in South Africa around the time I did it, so I was playing a transvestite, so I have no body hair whatsoever. And it's in like, you know, it's in the summer and it's in hot places like Malaysia and Singapore, so I just look like a plucked chicken. I have no body hair whatsoever. I'm quite hairy. And that was weird, for starters, when I saw it. And then also just the fact that I think, oh, that's the day where I spoke to my dad earlier that morning. And you know, it was layer upon layer upon layer of artifice and family dysfunction. Oh, guess what? My biggest kind of, not joy, but funny, proud fact about this book is that for weeks and weeks I was number one in the dysfunctional family charts on Amazon. And God bless America, they have a dysfunctional family chart.
So, annoyingly to people who make their living writing books, the book is beautifully structured and beautifully written. And the now...
Let's open our heart a little, Wes.
Well, the now sections is the drama of the television show that's unfolding as we're reading the book, right? That's the present day.
Yes.
The then is quite brutal.
Yes.
The then is your father being an abusive father, and you know, it opens with, you're going to read a bit for us, but I mean, it opens with a horrible scene of him cutting your hair with sheep shears or something, which you've blamed your many changes of hairstyle on the years.
You know, I have, it's funny because in The Good Wife, like I was shooting on The Good Wife today, and so for the first time ever, for the last few years, I've not been able to change my hair because I started doing it and I was doing a movie somewhere and I had black hair for it and they were like, oh, and they're putting white streaks in my hair to make me look older and more, you know, like a, you know, more sort of middle-aged man, even though I am one. And then they were like, gosh, you know, it's really difficult to get, I said, actually, you know, if I'm coming back for next season, we can cut out the middleman. I have grey hair underneath this. So I've had for the last...
I can't believe somebody as old as you has grey hair.
Isn't it crazy? And so for the last 4 years, I've had grey hair, and I've not really been able to change the style that much. In the summer holidays...
That's your excuse for dyeing it.
Well, no, then because I was doing Cabaret again. Because last season it finished and I didn't. Smack me, thank you. Cabaret. One of these weird things happened where I thought, oh, it's season 5, I'm out of contract, la la la, it's been nice. And then they said, would you like to do Cabaret again? I was like, oh, all right. And so the Good Wife were actually in second position to, and then they came back and said, you've got to do season 6, oh my God. So the Good Wife were in second position, so I had to dye my hair for Cabaret and they had to like put white things in it again. And then, it wasn't too successful, they weren't too happy. And then they made me this wig. I had a sort of 3-episode arc and died. They didn't like it.
Died.
Died.
Good.
And so now, like today, obviously I've got my black hair now, but the way that it's funny because when I go outside after Cabaret and sign autographs, there's a black playbill, so I have a silver Sharpie to sign my name. And every morning when I go, like this morning when I sat down at 5:45 in the hair chair, I sit down and there's just a row of silver Sharpies in front of me, because what did they put silver Sharpies? every time they come and do a take, they touch. It's called Last Looks. So they do your makeup, and then you kind of. I'm high on Sharpie fumes in every scene from the Good Wife. But the reason that it was I when my book came out and people started to read it at the Good Wife, they would come into the studio and go, I'm so sorry. Made you have your hair like this, because my father was really obsessed about my hair. My brutal, kind of, physically and mentally abusive father was really obsessed with my hair. And at the beginning of the book, this story I tell, he got into a rage and grabs me and takes me into the shed.
Is that the bit you'd like to read?
Oh, shall I? Well, I don't get to that part in the thing, but I actually want to read the memory is subjective part.
Then please continue with your story.
It's awful, it's horrible. And I really wanted to start the book with a kind of like a jolt to the audience of like, holy shit, what the fuck? Oh, sorry, I'm going to swear. I can swear, it's Philadelphia. Yep. And so he takes me, he grabs me, I'm like about 12, he takes me and he works himself up into a frenzy. And he was not, he was a crazy person. So he pulls me down and clippers my hair with these rusty old sheep shears that were in a drawer in the shed. So I look insane, I look crazy, like dripping blood and tufts of hair and awful. And so all my life I have had, like when I was late teens, even after I've left home, I used to vomit in the hairdressers. I have this. And I didn't understand why, because I'd suppressed all those memories. And then all my adult life, I've had more hairstyles than most of you have had hot dinners. And it has been obviously a way of me reclaiming my power, and my hair is a sort of a symbol of that. But the Good Wife has meant I haven't been able to do that for the last few years.
So when
the book came out, all these people were like, we're so sorry.
It's a very heavy beginning to the book. And I'm going to, you should read whatever you like. But I just want to ask you, did that always strike you as a very, I ask as a writer, a very good beginning for the book? Or did you struggle around for the beginning? Or did you start in different places? I mean, it's a really strong beginning, but is it just the way the book seemed to you? Was that, would you say, one of the crucial memories of really hard treatment?
I think, I went through various different ways to structure it and to begin it. And actually, I was going to do it the other way around, which was start at the night before my father told me this. I was hosting a big gala in Cannes, at the Cannes Film Festival. And I'm going to read a bit about that later. So I had this big show busy, in a way what you might think my life is like, beginning. And then I was going to plunge you into the darkness after that. But actually, I just thought, because of the structure of the then and now, this seemed a better way to kind of set the tone, because, really, in writing this book, I think what's been exciting for me is, and sort of scary as well, is that I present a more holistic version of who I am, because I think people know me in a certain way, and that's, I am that person, but my past is very different. So I needed to kind of jolt people into saying, hey, look, this is, here's who I, and I tell this very brutal, horrible episode, and then the next thing I go, you know what? It's okay. I survived. My mum survived. My brother survived. We're all fine. It's going to be okay. So let's just now tell the story. So it was kind of like a setting of the scene, really.
Read us a little bit.
So this bit I'm going to read is that in the course of the book, I had a really great editor at HarperCollins called Cady Thornton. And, you know, when you're a famous person writing a book, you'd be surprised how not keen they are for you to really write the truth, and but actually more to, like, you know, ha ha ha, you know, my frothy lovely life, who I've slept with, la la la. And so I was really surprised, and I didn't write a book for a long time since my last one, partly because I was like, ew, you know, these horrible people. If I wanted to write anything about myself, they wanted it to be sort of a tell-all frothy thing, and I just don't really want to do that. And I, you know, it doesn't interest me. So at one point she said to me, she thought that I should try and, for balance, try and think of some other things about my family that were happier. And so this is my response to that in the book. Memory is so subjective. We all remember in a visceral, emotional way. And so even if we agree on the facts, what was said, what happened, where and when, what we take away and store from a moment, what we feel about it, can vary radically. I really wanted to show that it wasn't all bad in my family. I tried so hard to think of happy times we all had together, times when we had fun, when we laughed. In the interests of balance, I even wanted to be able to describe some instances of kindness and tenderness involving us all. But I just couldn't. I spoke to my brother about this. He drew a blank too. We remember happy times with our mom, safe, quiet times, but as a whole family, honestly, there is not one memory from our childhoods that is not clouded by fear or humiliation or pain. And that's not to say that moments of happiness did not exist. It's just that cumulatively, they have been erased by the dominant feelings that colour all of our childhood recollections. I can remember us all in a Chinese restaurant in a nearby town. We hardly ever ate out together, so when we did, it was a memorable occasion. But there is something nagging, too, about my memories of that place, something that jabs at my heart when I think of it. I know that at least once in the few times we went there as a family, I must have been hit for some flaw my father perceived, must have tried to hide my tears and humiliation from other diners. We surely had some meals there that were free of his mood swings and his tongue and the back of his hand, but they don't stand out for me. I can remember when I was very little in the living room at Panmure. That's the country estate I grew up in. My father was a forester, so I grew up on a country estate. At least 4 or 5 years old, playing horsey with my father. I see him balancing me on the foot of his crossed leg as he watched TV, and him bouncing me up and down to my squeals of delight. I remember being genuinely filled with joy in those moments. But as soon as a memory like that settles for too long in my mind, another darker one forces it to slide to the side. I see a freezing wintry afternoon in the sawmill yard. I am on the red bike I was given for Christmas, and my father has decided that today is the day that I must ride it without training wheels. To this moment, I have never once tried to ride without them. There is ice and snow on the ground, and I see my father taking the training wheels off and pushing me down the driveway too fast. Every time he does so, I panic and fall off, and soon he gets frustrated with my failure and pulls my trousers down and slaps me really hard on my bare bum. It is so cold, I have no feeling in my toes and barely in my fingers. It is sore for me to sit down on the seat. I am scared, I am crying. And yet somehow my father thinks I'm going to be able to achieve what he has decided I must do. Each time I fall, despite my pleas and promises that I will practice and be able to ride without the training wheels soon, I am bent over his knee, feel the blast of freezing air around my genitals, and then severe, painful slaps to my behind. I don't remember how it ended. What I do remember is my mum washing me and getting me ready for bed in front of the living room fire later that night, and her gasping as she saw the ring of blue, black and purple bruises that had appeared. My father came in to say goodbye before he went out for the night, and my mother admonished him for his handiwork. "He's all right," he said, running a comb through his hair as he looked in the mirror. "You've gone too far, Ali," my mum replied as he disappeared out the door. Thank you. The show's on the floor. Well, the show's on the floor.
Tell us a joke. Your father, I mean, again, there shall be no spoilers, but he is a man who would nowadays be diagnosed with something.
He was mentally ill. Definitely. I feel like, you know, writing in the course of writing the book, I learned so much about myself and him and many things. And actually, you know, I was just telling Wes earlier, like last week in Scotland and London, I had this sort of an epiphany. I learned something else. And this whole process has been really a remarkable thing in my life. But I do believe that he was mentally ill, and the process of that summer led me to believe that, because in the conversations I had with him, I suppose from being so far removed from him after, like, you know, 16 years, and even when I saw him that time 16 years before, it wasn't a very...
That's an incredible scene when you go back to... It's your childhood home.
Yeah.
But he is now living there with your mother's replacement.
Yeah.
Who he got together with incredibly quickly.
Well, he was already
yes,
with her.
Yes, he'd segued. And then you go back and I shan't say which point of the story it is, but it's 16 years since you've seen him.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an incredible image of him kind of going back to the house.
Yeah,
on
I
his
went
own.
To like, basically, I...
It's a confrontation.
It's a I went, basically... So here we go. So this all happened to me. It was a silent house of fear, and we were all just terrorized by my dad. And we all escaped. My brother escaped earlier than me, and so it was a few years when I was just on my own. Those were awful. And my mom was just, you know, terrorized by him and tried to help us, but it was just, she was financially dependent on him. And then she managed to get out of that, and eventually she left him too. But then when I was about 28, I was trying to have a child myself, and I was married to a woman, and we were trying to have a baby. And the whole process of thinking about becoming a father brought up all these, you know, things about my dad I'd never thought about and totally suppressed. And basically, I had this kind of nervous breakdown and remembered everything. Well, not everything, because I sometimes still remember things, but... because of that, I then, you know, my brother and I went through that together. And then at the end of that, so when I felt a bit stronger, we went and did that thing where you go and confront your abuser and talk to my father about what happened and offered him the chance to still stay in our lives and, you know, give him an olive branch, but said that he needed to meet us and be an equal and be like an adult and a man. And he never contacted us again until 16 years later when he, So it didn't go too well. But so, that was...
Very intense scene. Just the intensity it struck me of going back to your childhood home after all those years. Just that. Forget what was going to happen, but place you hadn't visited or seen. And you tell us about that place a bit, because it's a very powerful presence in the book. Just the kind of... It's kind of a dead country house, as it were, just an estate.
Right? Yeah, so it's like a... I mean, I realised that I kind of grew up at the end of an era of these great country estates in Britain, and definitely in Scotland. So it was called Panmure Estate. It had about 50 farms, 50-something farms, thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of acres of woodland that my father was in charge of. And then the central bit is called the premises. I don't know why, but it's called the premises. That's, you know, the estate grounds. And there was a country. I mean, it's like, if you imagine Downton Abbey, it's like Downton Abbey without the Abbey. Because in the 50s, what happened was a lot of these country houses, and I wonder if that'll happen in Downton Abbey. That'd be fascinating if they had to do this. The world was changing. It was after the war. Yeah. There was a Labour government. The whole kind of the...
A lot of them
health.
Became like hospitals and all kinds of things.
All different things. But a lot of them, because of the death duties, what they did was they kind of stripped all the houses of anything valuable, all the kind of cornicing and all the statues and everything, and then blew them up. Just like exploded them. and raise them to the ground so that they wouldn't have to pay these taxes. Yeah, nice rich people keeping their, you know, their treasures for us, future generations. And so that's what happened to the one, the house that, Pamir House, which I saw photos of and everything, it was a place I'd go along.
When did they blow it up? In
the 50s.
And your father was a kind of a groundsman or a game...
He was a head forester.
Yeah. So he was really looking after nature.
He was looking after, like, our house where we lived was called Nursery House, the nursery in front of it.
Right.
Seed beds, trees.
But there was nothing public about this environment.
No.
So who owned it, though?
When we went there, when we first moved there, it was owned by a shipping magnate laid family, a rich shipping family. Then it was sold to a racehorse owner. Mm. And then finally it was sold to an insurance company. A lot of these estates were bought by as investments, as land investments by big companies. So it was bought by that. So there was never really the laird and the lady the whole Downton Abbey thing as
other places
were. But
there is a slight atmosphere of that without that presence.
Well, there was always people would come to my door or house and say, "Is the maester in?" And they would mean my dad. Mm. Like, he was the master of the forestry world. And there was a little bit of the old house left, with the chapel and the stables. They hadn't exploded, and so they used them for these shoots. So they're like, rich people would kind of come and rent. You could buy the lease of the shooting for a year. So there was gamekeepers and everything. And in winter Saturdays, I would be a beater, and you'd have to kind of go. It was so cold, and you'd have to go and, like, you know, hit trees with all these boys and walk through the forest, and the birds would fly up and those people would shoot them. So there was a whole kind of that feudal, kind of ancient, you know, old world thing was still there.
And to move more towards what you've ended up doing, not writing but acting. There's a really great scene when you're waiting for your letters to get into acting school. Or university.
Oh, well,
basically it's a route out.
I went to school when I was four, and so I had done all the exams you needed to get into university by the time I left high school when I was 16. And I thought, great, you know, I always used to think, why did they send me to school when I was four? I was like, because they wanted me out of the house, and that was kind of annoying. And then when I was 16, I was like, yes, I'm going to be able to get away a year earlier than I thought. But actually, none of the universities would take me until I was 17. But I had the only place that would take me was a drama school. And that wasn't why I wanted to go to drama school. But if I hadn't got in, if I went to university, I wouldn't have been allowed for another year. So I actually, and I think I wasn't allowed to go until 18 to drama. Anyway, I left school and I worked on a magazine in this publishing house in Scotland for about a year.
Tops
for Pop and TV. That was the one I worked on. And first of all, I was in the fiction department. When you first went, you went into the fiction department. So you actually literally got to do this. You pick up the phone, someone ring the phone, you go, "Hello, fiction." It's made me think that everything you're about to say was a total lie, which I loved. And I even got to write the horoscopes for the local newspaper, which is such fun. And then you got moved into a newspaper. And it's funny, last week I was just on Friday, actually, I was in London and I was on that show, Loose Ends, that radio show.
Yeah.
And the editor of that worked on one of these magazines and sort of, you know, poppy magazines in there. So I did that, and then I applied to the Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Drama because I'd done some plays at high school and it was the first thing I was any good at. And so I did some more plays, you know, and then I applied there and I got in. And if I hadn't got in, I don't know what I'd have done, actually. I didn't have a plan B. But that was really my escape from my father, was to get... And I was 17 years old and I moved across the country to Glasgow.
And that... and of course, because we're the same age, and I mean, I haven't been stalking you all that time, but we may well have been at the Edinburgh Festival at the same time, mm-hmm. you know, in similarly crummy productions.
Yeah. But speak for yourself.
I haven't been stalking. I'm not disputing you're a better actor than I am.
No, I'm not saying that.
but your acting career has obviously led you to this.
That's my bum, yeah.
Yeah, I bought that at a fantastic... I don't know if you can see Alan's bottom.
It says.
But,
it,
I, but
it
says. It's over there.
It says it's the art party.
It was a fantastic production of Genet's L at the Zipper.
The Zipper Theatre, the which doesn't exist
in
anymore.
New York City.
Steven Spinella, Anson Mann. And it was a play. It was a new version by me. It was a play.
There was a literal translation, and you had a free time with it.
I adapted it.
And
look,
it's signed by you.
Isn't that funny? My signature is a little more sloppy these days because I sign so many more things than I used to. So it's actually.
But I'm sure I remember you first in that. It's High Life?
The High Life.
Yeah, well, it was... I don't think it ever... Did it ever play in America?
I think it played in BBC America years ago when it first started.
It was
so
excellent.
Saw it, yeah.
It was excellent.
It was a sitcom about a crappy airline in Scotland.
And you were one of the flight attendants.
I was one of the flight attendants.
And then...
We wrote it. Me and the other flight attendant, we wrote it.
And then I think America probably first knew you properly in Circle of Friends.
Yeah. Oh, thanks.
And a few people like that movie. And then of course, the James Bond movie. Was that probably the thing where you felt you reached America for the first time?
Well, I mean, I actually, with Circle of Friends, I feel that I'd done a few films, and then that was the first film, even though it was made in Ireland, it was a European film, that it kind of actually, you know, had quite a big release in America, and I came to do the press for it, and I started to be asked. And, like, actually, I think I'd done GoldenEye... and Emma, actually, in the time between when, you know, I shot Circumference when it came out. So there's this kind of, like, year where I had these three big films all coming out. And so it was kind of I was new blood. So then I was asked to... And I came to America for the first... I didn't actually ever come to America until I was 30. So I think it really stands me in good stead. I have a very healthy outsider's eye because I had a whole, you know, life...
And you know, since then you've been, you know, well, we're going to open it out to questions because the time has gone very quickly. But since then you've been, you know, on the stage so much, and you've directed movies. You've been I've seen Spy Kids. I mean, you've been in so many movies, and also it's like nowadays it's like you're on every episode of Masterpiece Theatre. You're like in everything nowadays.
I'm Alan Cumming. And this masterpiece mystery.
And I think what my friend Andy would like us to do at this point, if it's okay with you, is to open it up to some questions from the audience.
Okay, I'm game.
And that's how we're going to take this to the end.
There's a lady.
They're going to bring this lady that microphone. Those people will pass it down the road towards her.
This is democracy
not
at work.
Not hijacking it on the way. And then she will say...
I will say, thank you for your wonderful candor.
Thank you.
Thank you. You are terrific in The Good Wife. You know
Thank
that.
You.
Since you're from Scotland, I wondered how you learned to be a political operative in the U.S., because you play it so well. And are politics very different in Scotland than here?
Might I say he's also a bit of a political operative in Scotland?
Yeah, I am, actually.
Are you?
Yeah.
Against English.
Yeah, well, against the Westminster establishment, not the English.
I
actually was last week. When I was in Scotland and in London doing press for my book. I went on as many political shows as I did sort of showbiz shows because I was so involved in the Yes campaign and so
Scotland just tried to secede from England, and it was a very close thing, you know.
Yeah, but. It's going to happen soon.
If you believe him.
I really think it is. I mean, we could go into that, but that's another story. But first of all, politics are very different in Scotland then, and that was just an example of it. But I think that stands me in good stead to play Eli. In my country, politics is not a hobby. It's not something that we kind of, you know, I think politics here is viewed as something that has these surges of around election times, and really the country... fully only engages in it at a general election. Sadly, the midterms don't seem to, which actually it should be the other way around, really, because we're voting for the cake instead of the icing, you know what I mean? So I think, and of course I think that it's, it behooves certain factions of the political world for people not to be politically engaged because they then don't realise what's going on and vote accordingly. Anyway, but so politics is a very different thing in Scotland, certainly. And for example, you know, so I'm very much, I feel I'm much more politically engaged than most people in this country, as I have been all my life. It's just how we are. We talk about it more. In this last thing in Scotland, the referendum, which obviously was a big deal, 86% of the population voted. That's double what voted in the last general election. Yeah. So I'm so proud of that. You can't believe how proud I am of my country, that there's that level of political engagement and political turning out. So the political bit, it's not so hard. But the American bit, I didn't quite. I mean, I've played quite a lot of Americans over the years, and when people ask, how can you do the accent, la la la, it's mostly because we are in Britain bombarded by American culture. Like something like 95% of the movies and cinemas are American. A large percentage of the TV shows are American. So we have access to hearing the American idiom much more than the other way around here. That's why American actors are not always so good at doing British accents.
Yeah.
But so that's kind of why. It's a kind of combination of these two things. What I didn't realise is how Chicago has its own personality. And I didn't get that at all. I thought I knew the country, LA, New York. I was kind of, you know, been to Chicago a few times. But only doing the show did I realise how corrupt it is. And how it wears its corruption on its sleeve as a badge of honour. It really is. And that, to me, is... I actually really love... It seems like the Wild West a bit, Chicago. And so that's been... I've learned that over the... And I was just in Chicago a month ago doing a thing for my book, you know, kind of a flying visit like this. And I really got it this time. I understood having wheeled around and meeting all these people. And I kind of understood it for the first time, I think.
I think I really understood Chicago when... They have a street there called Goethe Street.
Like the
G-O-E-T-H-E. Writer, huh? And they pronounce it Goethe. I couldn't get the guy to understand me when I told him where
God.
I wanted to go. Let's have another question for Alan before we totally run out of time. This young man right in the front.
Hello.
Hello again.
Again.
Again?
You're upstairs.
I was wondering, as a young actor, when you get a new role, how do you approach becoming the character?
I mean, I'm pausing because I want to say this in a way that will be, I feel, you know, some weight of responsibility in what I'm about to say to you. I think that I become that character as soon as I said yes to doing it. I just think I stand on a stage or in front of a camera and I just pretend to be someone and mean it. And I have skills where I can do an accent or I can change my body, I can do these things, but at the heart of it, at the core of it, all I'm doing is playing. I'm just playing like a little child plays. And all these processes, and like sometimes kids say to me, and when I meet drama students, they say, tell us about your process. And I always say, I am not a cheese. I don't have a process. Because I think in this country especially, there's been so much. And you'll probably, if you're going to train to be an actor, you'll have to encounter this. And of course, there's value to it and all these things and exercises. But really, all these things are things that are put on top of you trying to do the purest thing that you should be doing as an actor, which is just playing and just meaning it and just being it. So how I get into a character is if it needs research, I do it. If not, but really just me standing up and just being honest and truthful and using skills I have, that's enough. And I think you should always aim to pare away all the methods and processes and just be honest.
But that's also to estimate technique and the knowing of how to do the things you need at your disposal.
But those, that's
when
different.
You need, I know it's
that's
different but it's also something that's necessary.
I mean, obviously I understand that technique and skill is very, very important, but that's different from the method and the process and all these things that we talk about so much in American acting. And I really do think what they encourage is a selfishness within acting, and only to, for the actor to think about themselves and their performance. And acting is not a vacuum-like field. It should be a collaborative medium.
And in a sense, the way that in the book you say very clearly that the things about acting that are celebrity driven are very distracting and actually detrimental to the acting bit, which is the thing you like to do.
Yeah, I mean, like,
that's fair enough.
That's true. I mean, I think there's different, like, because people say, people confuse, like, and I'm an actor and I'm also a celebrity. But those are very different things. I've got loads of friends who are actors who are not celebrities. And so the thing I like about acting, one of the things I like about it most, yeah, is pretending to be someone else and being able to observe people and things. You can't do that when you're a celebrity. I can't, you know, that's the thing about the level of self-consciousness that you walk through your life with. It's not just that I don't like, you know, you get used to it, but you can't just be anonymous and watch people and study people anymore, which is sad because you become famous for being good at something and then you're not really allowed to,
yes,
to practice it. It's terrible.
Who wants to ask a question? There's somebody over there. Look at that person there.
We saw your performance of a reimagined Macbeth maybe a year ago. I'm putting the timetable together, and it's probably why you're writing your book. And I was wondering how the torture of the character and your writing of your life, did it interact at all?
I mean, that was during the time I was writing the book. I didn't get much done during Macbeth. I was a little preoccupied. But I, you know, the version of Macbeth I did was about a man who is brought to this sort of Victorian institution and there's something terrible has happened to him. And it really was one of the most difficult and upsetting things I've ever done in my life. And then in the course of this dehumanizing thing that happens to him, he recites the entire play of Macbeth and you realize that it's in order for him to... he does that in order for him to realize what he has done, what has happened, why he's been brought there. So it was intense. But my ability... I mean, I am a fun person and I'm... I mean, really, I think everything that I write about in my book and my childhood and my life, you know, there's... I can access darkness very easily. I know darkness, but I choose to stand in the light. And so sometimes, I guess my work, I mean, that's what I say about my grandfather, that I feel it was so heartbreaking because I saw someone very like me. I realized my granny was, I was my granny's favorite, I think, because I reminded her of him, because I was reckless and a bit mischievous and I've got the crazy in me. And I think I have been able to use my work, or my work has been able to use that to go to dark places and to do things. And that maybe is what makes me exciting as an actor. My grandfather didn't have that outlet. And, you know, he ended up putting a gun to his head in Malaysia. Acting is, I take it... I don't take it lightly, but the darkness that I have access to is to do with my past. And but I want to stay in the light.
What a great
not answer. The spotlight, just the light.
And those scenes, him driving from him on his motorbike, taking messages from across the.
Yeah, he was like a daredevil. He was like Steve McQueen. Yeah, he really was.
They're great scenes.
Can you tell us about your early days of auditioning? Was it difficult? When you came to New York, did they just hand you Cabaret, or did you have to go through a struggle? What happened? How was it?
Or your early days of auditioning prior to America.
Yeah, I mean, like, Cabaret had actually been done in London. I first played the MC in London 20 years ago. Isn't that scary?
Sam Mendes production.
Who you went to Cambridge with. Yeah, so Sam Mendes, we did it in at the...
Jane Horrocks was
Sally Bowles. Yeah,
right. Yeah,
she was my first Sally Bowles, and we did that at the Dormer Warehouse in London. And then 4 years later, it came to Broadway with a more full production with Rob Marshall co-directing and choreographing. But so when I came to New York, I didn't audition or struggle. I was, you know, I came. It's like a movie. I came to New York as a Broadway star.
You were fully formed.
I was. I was driving from the air, and it was so funny because I didn't really understand what was going on. I was very naive, and I'd been to Hollywood and made a couple of movies, but I hadn't ever. So I remember I was making a film in Czechoslovakia. And people say, oh, what are you doing next? And I said, oh, I'm going to this play I did in London. It's going to be a run in New York. And I remember I was driving in from the airport and I saw my name on a billboard. And I was like, oh. And even things like the press lady who was sort of, you know, the press person I dealt with, the publicist. I remember the first night and, you know, doing all the stuff you have to do. And I remember saying to her at the end, I said, oh, it's been so great. And, you know, thanks. I guess we won't really talk to each other very much anymore. Thank you so much. It's been lovely. And she was like, oh, well, but, you know, award season is about to start. And I was like, what's that? What's award season? And so I was completely green. But early days, you know, when I was in Scotland, I actually am annoying and I've never really, I've always worked. I've never done another job that's not what I wanted to do, and so when I left, I actually started working before I left drama school, and I just I'm actually really annoying.
You've never had those kind of empty periods. I'm going to do a little being a waiter now between jobs.
Never. And I've always been quite eclectic. I've always written or, you know, done other things and did the stand up comedy thing.
You do. I mean, it's very. I mean, you know. Photographs.
Yeah.
Perfume.
That's not always
been my... Second Coming.
The Second Coming is my fragrance now, yes, that's true, yes. First one was called Coming, so, you know, obviously.
But, you know, you
but
do...
But those were like, you know, those were not... Those were things because I was famous.
A novel was not because you were famous.
But it probably got... More likely to get published because I was famous. I got more attention because I was famous. I mean, you know, I think it was okay, and I'm very proud of this book. But I'm also not unaware of my power. You know, I think you should be.
But how nice to have, if one has any power at all, to be able to publish a book like this. Because what we were talking about backstage was that a lot of people who've gone through those kind of situations perhaps don't find themselves. In later life, with not only the ability to get a book published, but even the ability to voice a thought about it, the fact that you were able to do this, and it's a, you know, it's a wonderful book.
But it's also been like this is one of the things.
It's been good for your
family.
It's
been great for my family. I mean, this is what I'll tell you about my epiphanies last week. So, or since the book came out, I didn't quite. I knew that it was going to be something great for me because during the writing of it, it was so revelatory, and I learned so much. About myself and about my father and about everything. But I was nervous about putting out there into the world. And I was really nervous about how it would affect my mum and my brother, who were completely supportive, and I wouldn't have published it without their blessing. But they're not used to, you know, having the focus put on them. And it's as much their story as it is mine. But they have been incredible. And actually, last week in Edinburgh, I saw them and I realised, we talked about it actually, how I didn't quite... bargain for this, that the fact that we have our story is out there in the world. We do not have to protect my father anymore, because, you know, that's what you do with abusive people. The abusers are protected by the abusees because they're ashamed of it all happening. So that whole cycle is no longer there, and also we've put this story into the world and people are being so supportive and amazing and amazed by it, and that has helped my mum and my brother so much. And also I realized that I thought in some way this was some sort of thing about needing to, you know,
get rid,
expunge my. Yes. It was very much like I am expunging this. I'm expunging my life story to you all, because I think I need to say, I need to put it out there and go, holy fucking shit, this was crazy. But I didn't think that what obviously I have not. My father is always going to be with me now. I dealt with him. He was away and he was in the past and he was somewhere else. And I have just brought him. He's right here beside me. But he's here on my terms. And he should be. He's my father, you know. He's my father. He made me. And I really feel it's been an amazing epiphany for me to realize that I'm never, what I thought I was doing, actually I've done it, but in a completely the opposite way to what I thought. I've ended it all, but I brought my father closer to me.
It's a beautiful way to end this. Ladies and gentlemen, Alan Cumming.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, cool.
Thank you.
And Alan will be signing books very shortly.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.